This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
Hi, welcome back to Money Markets. I'm Dan from Shares, and with Laura off for the next 10 months or so, there's some pretty hefty podcast shoes to be filled. And first into the breach is one of our semi-regular guests and self-confessed pensions geek, Tom Selby.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, good to have you on the podcast, Tom.
An absolute joy, as always. I don't know if I'll be able to fill those shoes, to be honest, but I'll fill them in a different way, mainly with pensions and retirement content. So this week, we're going to look at why pensions tax relief is once again back in the headlines, the possible return of earnings guidance from companies and what this could mean for investors, and which sectors could be most affected by the long-awaited return of kids to school. But first up, Dan, what's been happening in the markets this week?
Well, I mean, as we're recording this podcast, it's really good to see that markets are picking up because there's sort of quite a few rubbish days. European, Japanese stocks have sort of struggled a bit, but Chinese and US stocks have done quite well. There's some sort of key stories that are being grabbing investors' attention in recent sessions. One of them is Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe stepping down for health reasons. Now, just before that got announced, there was lots of speculation that this was going to be happening, and the Nikkei 225 index was falling 1.4%. And what has actually happened since that Abe has sort of confirmed he's off, the market's actually slowly picking up. And I was sort of quite surprised by that, because I sort of feared that people would look at this and say, look, a change in Prime Minister could potentially lead to different policies. But actually, it seems to be that lots of analysts are expecting sort of a continuation of the current policy at the moment. So really, under his sort of, since he came to power nearly 8 years ago, in Japan, the TOPIX index has returned 85% in dollar terms, including dividends. Now, that's less than the S&P 500, but much, much better than you saw the MSCI Europe and the MSCI Emerging Market Indices. So really, dividends of Japanese companies have doubled and buybacks have quadrupled since he's been in power. So this is one of the main things that's happened. He sort of introduced various market-friendly reforms, including Japan's first stewardship and governance codes. And really, you've seen companies being much more thoughtful towards shareholders. So that's why you've seen the much greater dividends. And really, actually, you've got quite a few shareholder activists have almost been given a bit of a freer rein to challenge management as well. So Japan has been certainly in focus on the markets, and on the US market, we've had Tesla just doesn't stop. It's up 468% year to date. So
wow.
It's now come to the market, says it's going to seek to raise up to $5 billion in a share sale. But importantly, this is not going to be happening all at once. It's just as and when it wants to sort of tap the market for a bit of money. So Tom, I don't know, are you a driver? Have you got a Tesla car?
So I don't have a Tesla car. I was a driver, although not a very good one. So it took me four attempts to pass my driving test. And the first attempt I crashed into another car, which I think affected my confidence for the three following ones. So I owned a little Corsa in London for a while, and then my partner at the time managed to crash that while I was in the car as well. Nobody was hurt. It was fine. Nobody was hurt on my driving test either, other than my pride. But I've since the second car crash, I've decided, both for personal reasons, because you don't really need it. I'm based in London, so in London it's quite hard to justify having a car anyway. So and I certainly wouldn't be stretching out to join the Tesla bandwagon anytime soon. We also don't have very good parking around here anyway, so I'm not going to be driving Tesla any higher than they are already. But I'm sure Elon Musk can get over that.
Yeah, well, I mean, investors have just been going crazy for this stock, and I think if it was to obviously raise a massive chunk of money in the not too distant future, it actually gives it some pretty interesting opportunities, because it's been slowly sort of trying to pay down debt, which is obviously very positive. If you look at a company from an investment perspective, reduced debt or even going to net cash positions is obviously seen as a pretty good quality. Now, Tesla also needs money to invest in quite a big product pipeline, such as it's got a pickup model, a semi-haulage truck. It also wants to continue expanding its international operations, and it's got plans for European manufacturing and battery center in Germany as well. So Tesla won't be not short of things to do. It's raising money, but it's quite interesting how investors seem to think that there is so much coming from this, this company, and it is like the hot stock to own. Actually, I think quite right. It's the second best performing stock in the US after Zoom. The conferencing stock. Well, I'll touch on Zoom a bit later in the podcast, but just on the UK market, we saw shares in the over 50s insurer and travel operators Saga had a big rally after it sort of made an announcement saying it's going to raise a big slug of cash. And it's got a strategic investment coming from its former chief executive and owner, Sir Roger Dahan, who's going to be putting in money at a very large premium to last week's share price. So now what's quite interesting is it had a takeover approach from a consortium of two private equity firms, and it turned that down. It thinks that the current model of getting money from Dahan and the other investors is perhaps a bit better for its future. Now, this is a company that was doing very well, extremely strong brand, and it sort of, there was a big strategy mess up with its insurance activities. So, and also it invested heavily in cruises, seemingly they got the timing a bit wrong, spending money on new ship when obviously COVID came along. But I don't know, it's stuff I keep reading seems to be suggesting that appetite for cruises is not going to just disappear. There's still a very sort of passionate, loyal following amongst certain types of people who love cruises, and this sort of leisure activity will just bounce back.
It's quite an odd one, isn't it? Because personally, I've never been on a cruise, but I can't imagine that the experience would be the same if a cruise has got to have all sorts of COVID-19 guidelines, which mean that you can't be in small spaces and kind of socialize and interacting in the same way. But clearly some people think otherwise.
Yeah. So over the weekend we saw two of the major Sunday newspapers lead with a story about Chancellor Rishi Sunak potentially planning a big tax raid on pensions to help pay for COVID-19. Now, we had a chat about potential changes to tax on a recent podcast, but it's very much front centre of what's going on. So we thought it was well worth having another look to see what's happening. So, Tom, give us an overview of what is going on and should savers and investors be quite worried about these speculative shifts?
So I think that the first thing probably to say is that whenever there are these speculative stories ahead of a budget or ahead of a big fiscal announcement, you need to take them with quite a large pinch of salt. So I think I've mentioned previously when on the podcast and talking about similar matters that I think every single budget and every single autumn statement and everything in between where the Chancellor's been about to stand up on the lectern in the House of Commons and make a big statement, there's been various policies that have been flown up flags by the Treasury to test public opinion that 9 times out of 10 don't turn out to be reality. So this is very much the Treasury or people within the Treasury trying to find out how the public react to different ways that it could potentially raise money. But there clearly is an issue for the Treasury to overcome. So obviously, as we've talked about before, there's a huge deficit in the public finances. So the government's is going to have to borrow somewhere in the region of £300 billion more than it expected to over the 2020-21 tax year. And so inevitably there was going to be a debate over how to get that money back and the extent to which that should be done immediately and then the extent to which it should be done over a longer period of time. And we've seen some already in response to these stories, some Conservative MPs have been saying that this should be treated more like a wartime debt, so something that shouldn't be paid off immediately, but that just should just be added to the stock of debt and hopefully paid over time as you hope the economy grows and gets back to normal. But in terms of the stories that appeared, so it was in the Sunday Times and I think the Telegraph as well over the weekend. So in terms of things that could affect savers and investors if they were introduced, and there's no guarantees at all over either of those things. So the key measures that were floated were reforms to capital gains tax, reforms to pension tax relief, a very common one over the years, and possibly changes to the state pension triple lock. So I'll just kind of run through where things are at the moment with those and perhaps where they might go to if the government were going to introduce any reforms as part of this project to pay off some of the COVID deficit. So capital gains tax can be quite complicated, but in a nutshell, you get an annual exempt amount of capital gains that you can make of just over £12,000, so £12,300. There are various complicated gift allowances that exist as well that allow you to give money to people on certain occasions over your lifetime. But if you go over the capital, the annual exempt amount and outside of your gift allowances, then you'll be charged 10% CGT if you're a basic rate taxpayer and 20% if you're a higher or additional rate taxpayer, with an 8% surcharge if that if the capital gain is on residential property. So that would be 18% if it's within the basic rate band and 28% if it's in the higher rate band. Now, the idea that's been floated here is potentially aligning capital gains tax with income tax rates. So we don't know exactly how that would be done, but we do know that Rishi Sunak's already asked the Office for Tax Simplification, which is a quango just outside of government, to look at ways to simplify CGT. And so one of the ways you could imagine it being simplified would be if you, rather than having these separate sets of allowances and rates for capital gains tax, they're aligned specifically with the way that income tax works. So you have the first band £12,500 where you pay 0%, and then the second band at the basic rate where it's £37,500 for your next earnings, and then you have the higher rate above that and the additional rate above that. Now, if that were to happen, and again, I can't emphasize this enough, we don't know what's going to happen, but if that were to happen, then it might mean that people who make capital gains outside of tax wrappers, so outside of things like pensions and ISAs, could potentially be subject to more tax on those gains. So at the moment, the most they'll pay if it's residential property is 28%. If it's other investments, it's 20%. If there was an alignment of CGT with income tax rate, then you might be talking about a tax rate on capital gains of 40 to 45%.
That's quite a big hit, really, isn't it?
It would be significant, and if it were to happen, then clearly there would be anyone who's, for example, got significant investments in a general investment account would need to consider whether keeping those investments in that place where they could be subject to CGT is the most sensible thing to do, or whether it's worth considering putting them into a tax wrapper such as an ISA or a pension. But again, we don't know what's going to happen, and we don't know the timings of what's going to happen either. You would expect the government to, if there was going to be some sort of reform, to give people a decent kind of amount of time to let them know when this was going to happen. It would be quite a complicated set of reforms, so there probably need to be consultations as well. So if there were to be changes around CGT, I wouldn't expect it to be overnight. You'd think there would at least be a few months grace period to get the reforms in place.
So potentially we could see this announcement towards the end of the year, and then maybe of the new tax year, do you think?
Yeah, so we're expecting, so the budget is going to be, I believe, in November has been flagged, so we'll get whatever the Treasury is going to do on these various things, we should hear something in November. The thing is, you never know. You never want to rule anything in or out. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that the government could look to try to introduce something overnight. So that was what happened with the stamp duty changes that were announced at the mini budget, for example, which were clearly about stimulating the housing market. So you can't rule anything in or out, but it would be a surprise to me, certainly, if they look to do something as complicated as this overnight without at least a period of consultation with the various different people involved. Of course, the difficult thing for the Treasury, if they were looking to raise money, is the more time you give people to be aware of the changes that are coming into place, the more people will adjust their affairs, move their money around to make sure they're not going to be hit by capital gains tax as a result. So that will be those will be the kind of things that the Treasury will be thinking about. Like I say, my gut instinct is that they wouldn't do that, partly as well because, frankly, a lot of the people who would be affected by CGT are core Conservative voters and ministers as well in the government, frankly, and there'll be people who are looking to shore up their seats ahead of the next general election, which feels slightly ridiculous to be thinking about now, but politicians are always thinking about getting themselves elected again. And if anything that was going to potentially hurt the central part of their votes is likely to be resisted by those ministers, and we've already seen that after this story came out. So it's a tricky one for investors. I always say, rumor and speculation happens all the time, and you shouldn't change your long-term plans as a result of it. But equally, if you are fearful of a big rise in CGT or a hit to CGT, then it's worth looking at the products that exist that are free of capital gains tax. And if that works within your current financial plan, then it can make sense to look to move some money out of an environment where it could be subject to CGT and into an environment where it isn't. But that needs to be in line with your long-term strategy and your long-term savings plan.
Yeah. So some of the other stuff I was reading, looking at the options for Mr. Sunak was potentially jacking up council tax, a little increase in VAT and corporation tax as well. And all these could raise billions of pounds. So clearly, there's lots of things you can do, can't there? So I mean, do any of those sort of areas sort of take your eye and think, actually, you've got to pay attention to those
questions? I thought the thing that caught my attention most was the fact that this was just kind of a random slew of possible ways. It's essentially, it seems to be the Treasury looking at and trying to get feedback on all the different ways it can raise money in a way that I suspect it sees as affecting the amount that consumers spend in the shops as little as possible. So that's why, when you're looking at things like capital gains tax, the Treasury, I'm sure, will be thinking that's potentially a way to raise some money without stopping people spending money. Pensions tax relief, I mentioned at the top. So there's it's the kind of annual rumor that pension tax relief is going to be reformed, so that we maybe we'll move to away from the current system where you get pension tax relief at your marginal rate of income tax. So if you're a 40% taxpayer, you get 40% relief. If you're a 20% tax rate payer, you get 20% relief. So this idea that the government could introduce a flat rate, potentially at the lower rate of 20%, has been floated many times, but has never actually happened, and nobody's really talked through how it would work on a practical level. There's various hurdles that exist, particularly for defined benefit schemes, where it would potentially become complicated. But it's pretty clear that there's no strategy, I think, at this stage. There's no particular group of people that they want to hit, but they want to see what the feedback is, I expect, from voters and from MPs as well, and where and I guess which of these possible measures attracts the least ire, because there's obviously a balancing act for the Treasury and for Rishi Sunak in terms of wanting not to choke off any recovery and needing to raise at least some money to begin to balance the books. And I think the one measure which we talked about before, which we haven't just picked up on yet, is the state pension triple lock. And again, there's rumours that may be, so this is the promise from the government to increase the value of the state pension in line with the highest of average earnings inflation, or 2.5%. So retaining the triple lock's expected to cost the Treasury about 6 billion over the course of this Parliament compared to just increasing the state pension in line with CPI inflation. So that's potentially an area where it could save some money. But the problem for the government around the triple lock is that it promised, it was part of its manifesto. So it promised to increase the state pension in line with the triple lock throughout this parliament. And while we're clearly in a very difficult time for many reasons as a country, but the Exchequer in particular is under a lot of pressure, whether or not voters will be comfortable with the government going back on a pledge like that and something that's going to hit those in receipt of the state pension who tend to be quite big voters remains to be seen. So they've kind of thrown out a load of possible ideas. I'm sure are going to get a lot of feedback both from angry readers of national newspapers and from people within the industry as well. And then it feels like the starting point of them looking to draw up ways to raise money without too dramatically affecting the economic recovery that they and everyone else hopes to see.
Yeah. Going to be, I mean, it's going to be watched so closely, isn't it? And I'm sure the speculation is just going to get worse as we sort of get closer to when the budget might happen.
I'm sure it'll become more furious and hopefully more specific. Because, like I say, at the moment, it feels like they've just thrown a load of thrown the deck of tax cards on the floor and said which ones could potentially be picked. And I think in reality, most of us have got no idea at this stage. And I don't think the stories at the weekend gave us any real new information. It's kind of obvious that the government will be looking at all these different things, but there's no clear steer in terms of the things they actually want to do. So as you say, it'll be a case of keeping an eye on them, keeping an eye on some of the newspapers and seeing what else is floated, but also not taking any of this stuff too seriously or too literally. So COVID-19's also had a knock-on impact on the amount of earnings guidance that companies are able to provide to investors, with the usual slew of corporate reporting pared back amid unprecedented uncertainty about what the future might hold. But Dan, there are signs that this might be starting to change, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that in the last sort of month or so that we've seen the odd companies will come out and say we're feeling in a better place, getting a sort of a feel about what's going on, how to operate in this new world, and they're reinstating their earnings guidance. Now that's really helpful for investors when they're trying to form a view on a stock. Just yesterday, the day before we recorded this podcast. I mentioned Zoom at the start, so the video conferencing providers. Its share price shot up 40% after quarterly numbers beat expectations, but it also raised its full-year guidance significantly. So really, it's a message that company's been doing well, and it thinks it will continue to do so. So more clarity on earnings potential does give investors greater confidence over a stock, if the news is good. And then one could feasibly expect this demand for the shares to go up. So I think, you've seen on the UK market, Serco, Tesco, and a smaller company called Laseco, amongst those have been giving explicit guidance now for where they think their earnings are going. And I do think that we're going to see more companies do this in September and October, particularly those that are scheduled to publish results fairly soon. And I think one of the issues is if you use sort of stock screening platforms on various sort of financial websites, and you're screening to see what the forecast earnings growth is for a company, you'll see some numbers, but actually in quite a lot of the cases, the analysts have withdrawn their earnings estimates. So those forecasts are perhaps painting a wrong impression of what's actually going on in the market. To have these figures reinstated and have fresh estimates, it's really, like I say, it's really positive. So I do think you'll see this. And actually Danish companies have been amongst those who have been reinstating guidance for their second quarter results, because the Denmark's financial regulators actually pushed them to predict what the rest of the year is going to be like, despite pandemic. So you've seen these companies like the Brewer Carlsberg and the wind turbine maker Vestas reintroducing their outlook for this year's sales and profits in recent weeks. But actually,
I was just going to say, do you think is there any possibility that that the regulator in the UK might look to do that? Or do you think companies are kind of doing it off their own bat anyway, and there's no need for a regulator to get involved in ensuring that information gets out to investors?
No. I don't think so at all. I mean, lots of companies don't have forecasts at all. They don't explicitly say this is what we're expecting. They may guide analysts, give them a steer about what's sort of going on. But no, I just definitely don't think that's going to happen in the UK. And actually, I think you're getting some sort of corporate figures who actually think earnings guidance should be banished completely. So there's this chap called Barry Diller, who's the chairman of the holiday seller Expedia, recently told CNBC that his companies will no longer provide long-term earnings forecasts because he reckons staff would be better off doing actual work rather than pulling together these earnings estimates, because he thought the system was open to abuse, where companies kind of always make sure that they beat and don't miss expectations, so it sort of triggers a positive reaction from the stock market. So this under-promising and over-delivering, I know lots of investors will look at a company and say, look, it's always very cautious, this is good. So when it does come out with something positive, you really know it means it. But I'm sure there are other companies sort of manipulating the system a little bit. But I think it's definitely a trend I think you're going to see picking up pace in the coming weeks. So I recently caught up with Begbie's trainer partner, Julie Palmer, about the state of play with companies struggling in the pandemic. So I spoke to her about the measures that can be taken to avoid insolvency, and about how companies are shortly going to face new challenges like deferred VAT bills that will need settling and government loans that will need paying back. So let's hear what she had to say. So Julie, the UK government's been propping up companies during the pandemic with various support packages. There seems to be some fears that we're going to see more businesses go bust once these support measures are withdrawn. Recently, I've been coming across something called fast-track CVAs, which could potentially save some companies. Can you explain exactly what a fast-track CVA is and how it could help?
Okay, well, what the profession is essentially looking at is a mechanism to try and preserve and keep alive businesses that have been affected by the pandemic but potentially didn't have viability issues apart from the effect on the trade that has caused. The issue with CVAs historically is they typically can run for quite a long term, anything up to 5 years on a contribution-based model. And for the whole of the period that the CVA stays live, typically the insolvency practitioner remains involved with that business. What we're now as a profession looking at is whether there's a mechanism by which the insolvency practitioner can actually be involved at the initial stage of the CVA. So the CVA of itself is a formal negotiation, a formal proposal with the company's creditors to look at what forbearance and assistance those creditors need to give to get the company over the short-term hurdle and then try and restore it back to viability. So typically what a CVA might be looking at, a CVA light as we call it, is looking at rescheduling payments to creditors, discounting those payments to creditors, and rather than the insolvency practitioner, who then becomes the supervisor if the CVA is approved, remaining in place for the whole duration for those monies to be paid across to creditors, what this proposes is that the insolvency practitioner is involved in the first element of that, i.e. the agreement with creditors and the formalisation of the proposal. But then thereafter, it's left to the company to see the CVA through to fruition by paying those monies across to creditors. So we see it potentially as a less cumbersome and a less costly model. So to help some of those businesses get over this initial hurdle and remain live, but without being sort of burdened by the ongoing involvement and the cost of an insolvency practitioner right to the end of the process. So it's a short-term mechanism of trying to achieve the same resolution with creditors.
So do you think actually that you'll see a much greater proportion of companies staying alive then as a result of this process?
Well, it's one of a sort of number of things that the profession is looking at, dealing with these exceptional times. And the reason for this is, some of the figures are quite sort of alarming. If you hear even the major banks are talking about potentially somewhere in the region of 800,000 businesses failing as things return to some sort of normality, That's a little bit of a finger in the air, because we just don't know at the moment, because nobody knows what the new normal quite yet looks like. Nobody knows what the effect of a second wave and a second lockdown might have on business. But I think the thing that is abundantly clear is the support measures, although they've been very successful in navigating the way through this storm for business, they can't go on forever. They are extremely costly. Things like the furlough scheme, very successful, but it does come with a high cost, and we know that's about to start being eased off and then finished. The fact that the courts have not been open for winding up petitions to be issued has helped companies obviously stay alive as well. But this sort of forbearance and support just can't go on forever. So we need to look at other mechanisms by which we can try and control the rate of insolvencies and assist those businesses that were good businesses before the pandemic to stay alive. And to put the numbers in context, typically we operate since the financial crisis at somewhere between 17 and 25,000 corporate insolvencies each year. So if we are talking about a potential failure of 800,000 businesses, even if 10% of those businesses fail, that's still about four times our normal run rate. So it's clear that we have to do something to keep some of these businesses alive and the right businesses, albeit that those what we call the zombie businesses that have been hobbling along without really achieving much since the financial crisis, I think we need to let some of those businesses fail and make sure that the money gets to the right businesses and we keep the right businesses alive.
Because I've heard people talk about that, saying that, you know, that the weak companies that are being propped up by the taxpayer should be allowed to fail. I mean, I guess you could look at that as a natural evolution of business where the weak fade away, make it room for the stronger. But I guess some people may say that that's not a very nice way of looking at things. But so I guess is that kind of what, is the government supportive of such a strategy? They recognise that some businesses just aren't worth keeping alive.
Well, we're faced with a very different position now than we were before the pandemic. So the mechanisms by which businesses stayed alive, the zombie businesses, as we refer to them since the financial crisis, are fairly well known. So the banks initially gave those businesses a high degree of support, partly because the banks were trying to address their own positions post Lehman's and the financial crisis. HMRC's time to pay scheme meant that large amounts of statutory liabilities could be deferred, large sums over long periods, and that helped those businesses stay alive. But also we've been in a very sustained period of low interest rates, which has meant that those businesses that haven't really been throwing off much in terms of profit have nevertheless been able to service their liabilities based on historically low interest rates over a long period. What that has meant, though, is that what normally happens, as you say, with part of this sort of natural process, this natural evolution that we normally see through a recession and then a recovery cycle, is those badly performing businesses are allowed to fail, and then the good businesses with good cash reserves are able to pick up the market share. And that's where we see a bounce back, to give it its current parlance, or a sort of recovery curve. We postponed that. So we had that long sort of U-shaped recession where we were just bumping along, not really performing well, not really coming out of it by keeping those businesses alive. So pre-pandemic, I think there was a crying need to let some of those businesses fail so that we could see a bit more of a sharp recovery. And I think the pandemic has only accelerated that because of the fact that there is only a limited amount of money to go around to support business. So my view is that that money should get to the good businesses and not be used just to prop up those businesses that in normal times should have been allowed to fail anyway.
Yeah. So come October, the furlough scheme will end. So do you think that's going to lead to sort of more companies getting into trouble, perhaps particularly ones that aren't fast enough in terms of cutting back on their sort of staff costs if necessary?
Inevitably so, because the furlough scheme has meant that a number of those businesses have effectively been able to mothball themselves over recent months. The other thing to appreciate, of course, is that if a business tries to restructure by making redundancies, that's not a particularly straightforward thing to do. There are various mechanisms by way of consultation, agreed payments, which can be expensive to long-term employees. So redundancy of itself isn't easy for a business to do outside of an insolvency process. So I think, the need to start paying those staff at their full levels again when furlough falls away without the business owner having visibility as to what the landscape looks going forward, and the fact that for some of those businesses, they're having to start from a standing position again. I think for many businesses, that's just going to be a cost that they won't be able to afford to pay.
And so they've also got those deferred VAT payments as well. I mean, is that, that's clearly could be an issue for the UK economy, really, if you suddenly got all those VAT payments. Is it next March that they have to be to pay those by? It's another big test, isn't it?
It is next March, April. So if you look at the sort of timelines here, the you know, the furlough scheme ends end of October. The courts at the moment for winding up petitions are closed till the end of September. You can't get a winding up petition. HMRC typically issue about half of those petitions. So that mechanism becoming available again to creditors sometime after the end of September, if there's no further extension, will mean that creditor action becomes much more prevalent again. And then rolling that forward to not only deferred statutory liabilities next March, April, but also the fact that some of the government-backed loans, so the CBILS loans, for example, there was effectively a deferment before those repayments needed to start being made. And that coincides around about the time that the deferred VAT payments need to be made as well. So looking forward to spring next year, that really is a sort of date high on our horizon. We think as we get to the end of the withdrawal of the furlough scheme, end of October, we'll definitely start to see a build-up in terms of the number of insolvencies. And I think that's only going to start accelerating as these deferred monies need to be start being repaid next spring, with as yet no visibility as to whether business or some business will return to anything like normal, or whether they'll find a way to pivot to a new normal that makes things sustainable going forward.
Great, Julie, thank you ever so much for joining us on the podcast. Really good to have you on.
And finally, let's look at the return of kids to school and the possibility of workers getting back in the office as well. So, Dan, I'm sure lots of parents around the country are relieved that they'll no longer be having to juggle their day job with homeschooling. And I've heard various complaints from various different parents about that particular setup, which doesn't sound much fun at all. But which sectors are in line to benefit the most as we all try to get back to something that resembles normal?
I do feel that we're at a bit of a turning point here, because you know, school's going back, and actually I think there's a lot of parents who will have been at home because they had no choice to look after their kids, and even ones at sort of secondary school where perhaps they don't need parents there or you know, after school and stuff like that. So I think that you're seeing, obviously, the government's putting pressure on companies to get people back in the office. And just anecdotally, I'm just seeing it all over social media feeds and people I know. Everyone is making preparations to go back in the next few weeks. So I think that if you go back a couple of months ago, everyone was saying, oh, we're all going to work from home forever. Not so sure that's quite the case. Now, there are obviously restrictions on the amount of people that are allowed back into a building, you know. So for example, Tom and I, we're going back fairly soon, but we can only take a certain percentage of the usual capacity just to keep social distancing. So it's not like we're going to return back to normal completely, but I think that there are going to be, you know, a good chunk of people going back to the office. So I think you're going to see you know, what happens at lunchtime. People are going to go out to get their lunch. So people in the food retail sector are probably looking at thinking, okay, I think we're going to get a big uptick in earnings here. But then I'm thinking, well, you know, you're going to go back to the gym. That's as people return to their old routines. They might go to the gym after work or something. But, you know, but while we've been in lockdown, a lot of people have just been looking at their homes and thinking, I'm spending all this time at home. I want it to look better. So the DIY sector is done quite well. But I'm thinking, if people start to go back to work in the office, are they going to start putting those sort of jobs back on the to-do list and not actually get them done? So I would be looking at sort of DIY sector and thinking, have, if they've been rallying, some of those stocks certainly have they seen the best days this year? I mean, a big question mark there.
Yeah, but I have to say, I went into this lockdown with very, very bold intentions, both of doing some incredibly worthwhile reading and, you know, the usual things that people went into, and also trying to do bits of DIY. And I'm currently sat in the bedroom with the mirror that I pledged to hang up 3 months ago. and it remains leaning against the wall. So I hope that those DIY companies weren't factoring in any spending from the Selby residents into their earnings forecast, because it has not happened.
Well, you know, we do have the housing market's doing very well thanks to some temporary changes to stamp duty in England. Yeah. So I think that perhaps there could still be the tailwind there, that if people are determined to get their house in the market in the next few months, might still be spending on DIY to do it up. But the other area I would watch very closely would be if we get some signs that there are more people than expected who are going back to the office. You know, one has to think, is that good for commercial property stocks? Because these companies have been heavily sold off on earlier assumptions of this great remote working trend and that we don't need offices anymore. But I'm wondering whether there will be some investors who think, you know, is this a place to put my money, potentially being, you know, it's way oversold, but you know, I'll leave it for listeners to make up their own judgment. But I will be looking at that sector very closely and any sort of indicators about the level of people that are at the back of the office. And just one final point, poor old tea round. I think that's dead, isn't it? I mean, keep reading about this.
Oh my God, yeah.
People are going to go back in the office, but they're going to be nervous about others making tea for them. So they'll bring their own hot water in to avoid touching the same tap as their colleagues.
I must confess. I never bought into the AJ Bell ground floor tea round. And that's not. It's not dead. You know, in all my employments, I've always eschewed being part of a tea round, and it's not because I'm antisocial or I just don't like doing favours for people. I just quite enjoy that as my like little. It's my own time, Dan. It's my own time to myself to go. I make myself a cup of tea. I stand, I think about different pensions things, and I'm on my own and I do it, and I get to do it, you know, 3 or 4 times a day. And if you do a tea round, that's going to be reduced by a quarter. And I don't want to do
that. It's interesting because, yeah, I work on the floor up from Tom, and I've noticed that none of us do tea rounds either. Maybe this is the modern culture, but I don't know why. It just seems to be. Like I say, for previous jobs, it's always happened, but not.
Yeah, I guess I guess people could do tea rounds, but perhaps with latex gloves on or something. Although that might look slightly weird. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, because I'm reading this stuff about people saying, they're worried that if everyone in the office is touching that same bottle of milk, you don't want to touch it and stuff. But it's, but then I sort of think there'll be lots of people who want to stand round the kettle and stuff, just having a chat, but we'll see. Obviously, there's going to be restrictions on that. Anyway, we're waffling about cups of tea. We're sorry.
Yeah, so that is all we've got time for this week. Thanks a lot, as always, for listening. Remember, you can listen to us on Spotify, on the iPhone podcast app, or on Podbean, and just search for Money and Markets. Make sure you tune into the next episode in a week's time. Until then, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
See you later.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell or Shares Magazine. The podcast isn't telling you whether certain investments are suitable or not. And don't forget that the value of investments can change and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that tax rules apply and that the way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.